The displays were giving Bruce a clear night vision view of the tunnel as it moved past him at an increasing rate. A digital counter in the corner continued counting down the seconds to the four PAM rockets shut down. The PAMs were propelled by solid fuel. It was efficient and relatively stable as propellants went, but once ignited, it couldn't be stopped. It had to burn its full duration. Each alone would have been sufficient to thrust the Batmobile forward significantly in normal conditions, but the enormous weight of the railcar might have slowed his exit enough to allow the Joker and his henchmen to toss something large in front of him and completely block his escape. So he had ignited all four at once. Even then, he was only guessing at the mass and resistance of the old railcar, and for a moment he was concerned the thrust wouldn't be adequate. Bruce saw now that he had leapt from the Joker's frying pan into a different line of fire, the transformation of the railcar into a rocket sled. The speed may not have been great compared to the normal operating limits of the Batmobile in these tunnels, but for a rolling stock railcar attached to the rails only by its weight and the strength of its open wheels, the velocity was beyond dangerous. They were a top-heavy, rocket-driven sled, and they were rapidly approaching a bend in the track.
Kronos, plot track forward and display.
300 meters to intersection with Diamond District Line.
Bruce glanced again at the PAM countdown to end of thrust. 15 seconds. At this speed, the corner was 4 seconds away.
Kronos, RCS control to manual. Status?
RCS manual and online.
Bruce gripped the controllers on either side of the pilot seat as the railcar entered the left curve. The railcar pushed hard to the right with inertial force, tipping precariously. Bruce slammed the lateral control hard to the left. The reaction rocket motors fired both front and back, pushing against the tipping mass. He held the thrust constant, watching the heat indicators on the thrusters climb dangerously high. But knowing the alternative to meltdown was an uncontrolled crash, the thrusters kept the railcar held through the curve, and the left wheels of the carriage slammed down as the rail tunnel straightened out before them. Bruce shook from side to side in the still-too-loose restraints, sweat beating on his brow. The turn had robbed some of their speed, but the continued burning of the PAM motors was quickly increasing the acceleration once more.
Kronos, track green to Diamond District Line.
Track green.
The red light on the line turned to green, the track points ahead having been switched. Wayne Enterprises had computerized the subway routing system back in 2004. Bruce had made sure that he knew the back door into the control system precisely for this purpose, so that he could manipulate the subway traffic and allow this version of the Batmobile to traverse beneath the city. It was normally a sophisticated system that subtly delayed or advanced the subway trains in such a way that commuters never knew that Batman was moving through the same tunnels.
Now's not the time for subtlety.
Suddenly, the light went red again.
Joker. He's using my own system against me.
Kronos, track green to Diamond District Line.
Track green.
The light turned green once more. It was barely in time. The rail car hit the rail points hard in another left turn into the main subway line. Bruce again slammed the translational controller all the way to the left, firing the side thrusters at full throttle. He could feel the carriage under him shudder under the contradicting forces. The rail car again fell hard against the track, but it was now on the main commuter line running around the city. Bruce knew that they were traveling west now on the southern circuit, a straight run for at least a mile before it turned northward. He glanced to his right. The Giello Park station flew past, its platform filled with the gaping faces of commuters, before the rocketing sled and its chained Batmobile cargo again plunged into the darkness. Then Batman saw the light ahead of him, the headlight of an oncoming train.
That's impossible. The trains on this route always run clockwise around the city.
Kronos, magnify ahead times 50 for 2 seconds.
The image of the subway train ahead of him suddenly leapt forward.
Empty. What's the matter with Joker? Couldn't he find a full commuter train in time?
Bruce pulled the straps on his restraining harness as tight as he could make them.
Kronos, start main drive.
The engine behind him spun up. He could feel the rumble through the seat.
Kronos, prepare to execute on my command.
Bruce settled his hands on the steering and drive controls, his feet resting in an awkward position because of the Batsuit still under him.
Minimize profile smooth. Stand by.
Ready. PAM cutoff in 3.
The train was closing quickly with a rocketing flatbed.
2.
Bruce held down the clutch, revving up the engine in anticipation.
1. Cutoff.
Execute!
He released the clutch. The reactive armor shell of the Batmobile suddenly collapsed inward, tightening to its smallest size and smoothing itself out. The chains that had bound it suddenly hung slack. They would still rake the car and possibly damage the adaptive armor, but Bruce hoped it would be enough to slip the bonds. The wheels of the Batmobile strained against the rough surface of the flatbed rail car. The Batmobile lurched rearward. The chains tore at the car, but with the Batmobile's exterior minimized, the restraints could find no real purchase in the smooth surface. The Batmobile suddenly sprang free of the chains, the wheels pushing the still careening rail car from under it as it shot backward. Bruce shoved the clutch back in, standing on the brakes at the same time. The Batmobile skidded to a stop astride one of the rails. The flatbed shot forward toward the oncoming train, derailing it as it jammed under the front wheels. The subway train piled up in the tunnel, folding on itself in a rolling wreck that filled the passage ahead. Bruce engaged the drive forward, skidding the Batmobile on the tracks and pointing it back toward Giella Park Station.
Kronos, plot course home, then display. Combat mode!
The displays inside the cockpit of the Batmobile suddenly changed. Weapons systems were coming online in the far right display, while the left-hand display showed the car's exterior shifting from transport optimization to adaptive armor. Heads-up targeting and maneuver display sprang to life in front of him, although without the Batsuit, he had lost some of the dimensional imaging.
It's not perfect, but it'll have to do.
The Batmobile shot forward over the rails. Bruce can now see the Clown Police's ATVs charging down after him in the tunnel.
Small arms and RPGs. They've come to play.
In the night vision display, he saw the flare of an RPG ignition from the back of one of the ATVs. Bruce reacted instinctively, turning the Batmobile into the path of the ATV that had fired on him. The rocket-propelled grenade slid past the Batmobile, exploding against the wall and kicking the Batmobile sideways. Bruce drove on. The ATV driver wavered for a moment, uncertain as to whether he should drive into the wall or cross in front of the Batmobile. It was hesitation enough for Bruce. He clipped the front of the ATV, sending both of its occupants sprawling into the tunnel. Then he turned slightly into the center, back onto the tracks, and accelerated.
Bowling for clowns.
The Batmobile plowed through the ATVs on the track, crushing two of them beneath its wheels. More bounded off the reactive armor, slamming into other ATVs and tumbling them all savagely across the tracks and against the walls of the enclosed tunnel. The remaining ATVs scattered out of the Batmobile's way, turning as quickly as they could to continue their pursuit. Bruce now saw the Giella Park Station platform on his left, still filled with commuters. He could make out their astonished faces as they watched the Batmobile roar past them a second time, now free of the rail car, pursued by what looked like cops in clown masks on ATVs.
With that commuter train blocking the westbound tunnel, it's going to be a long commute home for them.
The tunnel curved through the bowels of Gotham, snaking to the right and then turning hard to the north.
Fashion District coming up next. Track runs parallel with the City, Financial, and the Somerset Express lines under the old Cotton Station.
Bruce glanced at the rear display. The remaining ATVs were still behind him, though they were falling further behind. Through the night vision displays, he could clearly see the bright area of the Cotton Station platforms coming up, and the burning headlight of the scheduled commuter train closing with him directly ahead.
The regular commuter for the Diamond District. It has a stop here. I'll swing to the other track before we reach the platform and lead these clowns down the abandoned harbor line.
Bruce's eyes widened. The Diamond commuter train was not slowing down to stop at the station. He could see the panicked engineer frantically trying to work the suddenly ineffective controls. Bruce pitched the throttle full forward. The Batmobile responded immediately, surging forward down the track toward the rapidly approaching train. The Cotton Station had platforms on both sides of the track, but only one of them was now in use. There would only be commuters on the western platform. The east side platform should be deserted. Bruce hoped it was deserted.
Never play chicken with a train.
The Batmobile cleared the tunnel just moments before the train. Bruce kicked the thrusters again, to the right this time, shoving the Batmobile off the tracks and up into the east side platform. The back of the Batmobile shattered tiles covering the subway wall. Bruce slammed the brake pedal to the floor. The Batmobile skidded on the cement of the platform. The concrete wall at the north end was looming ahead of him. To his left, the train was still roaring through the station, its car still filling the tunnel at the northern end, leaving him nowhere to turn.
How long can this train be?
Suddenly, the last car cleared the tunnel, and Bruce kicked the thrusters to the left. The Batmobile slammed back onto the barely cleared tracks and vaulted back into the darkness of the subway tunnel.
Now that's what I call railroading! I say it's time we all enjoyed a little mass transit.
An empty train pulled onto platform 61. More trains approached behind it.
The clown police grabbed their weapons and piled into the open subway cars.
All aboard! It's coupon day, and everybody rides the ride!
The external optics had taken a beating, and their clarity had suffered. Some of the feeds were blurry from the right side of the car. Through the blur, however, Bruce could see something quite clearly. Another train, paralleling him on a second set of tracks, its doors open and filled with heavily armed clown police. Bruce throttled back suddenly. The train on the parallel track continued forward, braking in reaction. But it couldn't brake fast enough. Bruce wheeled the Batmobile around the end of the train, falling in behind the last car. He could see through the smudged cameras that the clown police were gathering quickly in the rear car, working to open the access door so they could fire rocket-propelled grenades. The momentum of the train continued to carry them forward into the tunnel of the old harbor line.
Wait for it. Wait for it.
The braking train shifted slightly as it crossed the switcher points to the old Coventry line and veered to the right. Bruce nudged the steering to the left. The Batmobile disappeared into the forgotten crosstown tunnel to Coventry as the clown train went down the side tunnel. But there was a train stalled on the crossing ahead of him. Another was roaring after him from behind. The red control lights were burning bright in unheeded warning. Bruce dropped the Batmobile precipitously down through an access conduit. The sounds of the collision of the trains fading behind him as the Batmobile fell onto the West Side University line below. The entire subway system had become a deadly gauntlet.
It's time for this mouse to leave the maze.
He roared past the university station up the Coventry line, only to find yet another subway car, packed with clown police, converging with the northbound rail and falling in behind him once again. Bruce swung the car off of the main Coventry line and into an abandoned tunnel. Just behind him, the points of the rail line suddenly shifted, and the pursuing rail cars careened into the abandoned tunnel after him.
He thinks he's got me. Joker knows I've gone down a dead-end spur, and he's sure he's won.
The fuel gauges were hovering just above empty, and the power reserves had dwindled to 8%. When they went, the armor would be ineffective, and everything could come apart. Ahead of him, he could see the barricade at the end of the line. Beyond that, the tunnel ended in an opening beneath the West Side Bridge.
Kronos, surface.
The train was nearly on him, the RPGs no doubt at the ready. Near the end of the track, a steel ramp dropped down. The Batmobile roared up the ramp just before it cleared the end-of-line barricade. The careening subway train full of clown police did not. Driving beneath the West Side Bridge, Bruce closed his eyes. He wondered if something far more sinister than the Joker awaited him at home. The old man's silhouette was framed in the panes fitted into the upper panel of the door, obscured by the Wayne family crest etched in the frosted glass. The silhouette was clear now. The outline of the overcoat and the slight gleam off the hatless, balding pate were both so familiar. There was something small and rectangular clutched in his left hand as he entered the dark space of the servants' hall. The balding man reached for the light switch, but the lights came on before he could reach it.
A little early Christmas shopping, Alfred?
Bruce was still dressed in the faux police uniform, his shoes crossed on the edge of the long table as he leaned back in the chair. Alfred recovered quickly. He crossed his hands behind him, taking a parade rest stance that allowed him to hide the package in his hand.
Master Bruce, my apologies. I understood you were to be out for the evening.
Plans change, Alfred. I see you have something there. What is it?
Oh, nothing, sir. Really. Just a little something I picked up for a friend.
Am I your friend, Alfred?
You are as much a friend to me as I could have ever hoped.
Well, then, old friend, let me see what you're hiding behind your back.
It's really nothing, sir. A nasty little joke, really. Could I interest you in a little something, Master Bruce? Some sandwiches, perhaps, or some chamomile tea? It won't take but a few moments.
No!
Alfred. Bruce's arm crossed the kitchen door, barring Alfred's way.
Master Bruce does not want his cookies or his milk. Master Bruce does not want to be coddled or put to bed.
I've been asleep far too long already. What I want is for you to explain that book you're hiding behind your back.
No, Master Bruce. This you must not do. I beg of you.
You beg of me?
I've never asked anything of you before, Master Bruce. I've done everything that was required of me. The family and of you, even when...
Even when what?
Even when you embarked on your mad crusade.
My mad crusade? Our mad crusade, Alfred. You've been a part of this mad crusade from the very beginning. Is that what this is all about? Does the faithful retainer suddenly have cold feet and want to pretend the past never happened?
I didn't know it would come to this, Master Bruce. I certainly never thought it would go this far. But the criminals were taking apart the city, and you were always setting things to rights. And I came to believe in what you were trying to do. I've dragged you, broken and bleeding, back to that black cavern of yours and patched you up more times than I care to count. And through it all, I've kept the secrets of this family safe. Now, I beg you, Master Bruce, leave this alone and let me handle it for you. That's part of my job as a press agent, isn't it? To handle messes for you?
Handle this for me?
Yes, Master Bruce, please.
Like your father handled my father's messes?
No, Bruce, don't speak of it.
Your father wasn't just SOS in the Second World War. I've checked his file. He was original SOE, Special Operations Executive for the British Secret Service. He was a guerrilla warfare expert, trained to fight the Nazis in their own backyard. It wasn't until late in the war that he was attached to the OSS. He was a spy, trained to operate in extreme conditions, tend his own wounds, kill without question, clean up after himself, so no one could suspect he'd ever been there at all.
How dare you? My father was a hero!
So was mine. That's what you've always told me. But someone's been pointing out the cracks in the marble statues we've built of them. Your father was enough of a hero to clean up my father's mess at the Arkham Asylum back in 1958.
What? How did you know?
Bruce snatched the book from behind Alfred's back.
Because I've already read the book, Alfred. And the letters from my father.
What letters? There were no letters.
In my father's hand and on his stationery. I'm relatively new to this, old bean. When did you find out about it?
Please, sir, this isn't going to help any.
When?
1967. Just before my father died.
Go on.
It was a heart attack. But then he was 69 at the time.
Alfred sat at the table. He was bent forward now, the paper-wrapped book turning in his hands.
It was right after his first mild episode in the spring that he called me in. He told me everything, just as Dr. Wayne had told it to him. The vision he had of using science to rid the city of crime by turning the criminals against themselves. Richter's bold ideas and the behavioral virus, and how everything had come apart so quickly. He told me he had cleaned up everything spick and span, as he used to say. My father said that he had done things in his life he wasn't proud of, but that he was hoping to make it right when he recovered. Then he had his massive attack a month afterward and left it all in my hands.
I must have made it easy to get your father's position. All you had to do was hint at your newly acquired wisdom to my father and make sure the facts were kept off the written resume.
How dare you?
So that's what this is all about? Your father covers up a brutal murder and now you're covering up for him?
My father kept the secrets of this family to his last breath. My father covered up for your father's complicity in setting the stage for a spree of murders at the end of the 50s and took that secret to the grave with him. And his son has been keeping those same secrets for the benefit of this family and its only heir for most of his adult life. It was all under lock and key before the Richter woman showed up.
Amanda?
Who else would it be? Oh, I knew she was trouble when she first showed up on the grounds. Now it's missing. The files, the films, the tapes.
Tapes? What tapes?
Your father's recorded diary. The reels have all gone missing.
So you've known about this my entire life. But that's not all, is it, Alfred, old friend? There's more to this than my father's funded experiments having gone wrong. Something you're not telling me.
Bruce, I've taken care of you your entire life. You are as much a son to me as my own flesh and blood could have been. I am telling you for all our sakes that you must let me handle this for you. You must stay out of it entirely. And if you do this, I promise you, Everything will be all right.
Why the hell would you think that? All these years fighting the darkest souls of humanity? Why would you ever be so stupid as to think you could bargain with a blackmailer?
Because it's always worked before. This isn't the first time I've heard from the Richters. Their requests have never been unmanageable, and it was your father's wish that they be taken care of. I've always quietly taken care of the problem, and they've always gone away. But this time...
things got out of hand. Bruce and Alfred stared at each other. Answer it.
I don't...
Now. Alfred stepped sideways around Bruce and walked briskly toward the wall phone.
Wayne Manor, how may I help you?
Alfred looked at Bruce. Bruce nodded.
Yes, I have it. She has the tapes. She'll exchange them for the book, but she has not yet told me where to make the delivery.
Like hell. I've been chasing that book across the city. Even the Joker tried to keep me from getting back here tonight as I followed that book. A book that led me right back to you. And when I got back here, do you know what I found?
No, sir. How could I? I just got in myself.
Bruce held up an invitation envelope.
It's identical to the one delivered to everyone in the city. It was waiting on the table, this table here in the servants' hall when I came in. There was no name on it, so I opened it.
But I locked the house. The security system was engaged.
The same security system that allowed Amanda access to my mother's garden? Well, I see we'll need to take a look at upgrading it.
He pulled the plain invitation card out of the envelope, holding it up in front of Alfred's face so that he could read it. To a gala in your honor, Kane Mansion, midnight tonight.
Kane Mansion? That residence has been boarded up for 2 decades.
How convenient that it's right next door. I think I'll accept.
No, Bruce, you must not go there.
Alfred grabbed Bruce's wrist with a surprisingly strong grip.
You have no idea where this hole leads, nor where the darkness ends. Your parents are dead. The past is buried with them. Let them rest. I've taken care of this family my entire life. It's all I have and all I ever wanted. Leave it alone, Master Bruce. Stay here and everything will be all right.
So I'm back in short pants again, am I, Alfred? You'll clean up the mess and I should just go on with my life? What life? I can't rest because of the life I live. I run after some elusive dream and...
Joe Chill running down the alley. Bruce cannot catch him. He can never catch him.
And every time I think it's in my grasp, it vanishes and is replaced by some new threat to the city. Gotham balances on the edge of an abyss, and I feel the weight of holding it there. What kind of a life is that?
An important life. A necessary life. A life given so that others might live theirs.
I'm not that boy in the alley anymore, Alfred. It's time to put an end to these games.
No, Bruce. You must not go over there. There are some things that need to stay buried. I won't let you.
Alfred, you're fired.
What, sir?
I said you're fired, dismissed, downsized, or whatever you prefer to call it.
You can't do that.
The hell I can't. You crossed a line. You're standing between me and my prey.
What prey?
The truth!
The truth can be a terrible beast, Master Bruce. Sometimes the truth hunts you.
Get out. Out of the manor, off the grounds, and out of my life.
No, sir.
Get out while you can, Alfred, because this is the only parachute you're gonna get. Cheer up. You're about to get a very nice severance package, including medical, which I sincerely hope will not be needed in the near future. But don't bother packing. It'll all be mailed to you. Just take the Bentley and consider it a bonus.
Sir, please.
Get out!
Alfred had lied in order to hide something from him, had been hiding it his entire life. It was a betrayal that Bruce could not accept, and it left him more alone than he could ever recall feeling. He looked at the invitation once more.
It's time to put an end to this game.
Amusement Mile, Gotham, 10:55 p.m., October 25th, 1958.
What do we do now, boss?
Shut up, Salvatore. I gotta think.
The slug in Julius Moxon's right shoulder had lodged in the joint and was excruciating. He gripped it with his left hand, trying to stop the blood and keep his arm from moving at the same time. He leaned heavily against the wall in a narrow alley between the milk bottle throw and the balloon dart game booths. A group of his boys were jammed in the tight space around him, The lights of the midway beyond the alley were bright and harsh, swaying overhead in the October wind. They cast heavy, shifting shadows across the faces around Julius, faces reflecting his own fear.
Okay. Who we got left?
Hard to say, boss.
Salvatore pushed up the brim of his hat with the muzzle of his Thompson as he tried to see down the midway.
Ricky and his boys were all hanging from the Ferris wheel like they was Christmas ornaments or something. Somebody ought to go over there and stop that thing from turning. It ain't decent them swinging like that.
You do it, Salvatore.
Like hell, Jonesy. I ain't walking out for no guys that's already dead.
The fat killer called Kelly the Kelvinator was sweating despite the cold.
I thought that was the whole point of robbing the Gotham National in the first place. Lure these apocalypse jerks here with the bait, and then whack them with heat from all the mobs at the same time. Bye-bye, apocalypse, and back to business as usual.
Everyone in the alley looked up at the corrugated steel roofing above.
Yeah, well, it looks like the apocalypse isn't following the plan.
Quit flapping your gums and reload. We gotta find a way out of here.
Who done that to you, boss?
Salvatore nodded at the boss's bleeding shoulder.
That disciple jerk, I think. I put a slug in him, though, before he took my brownie and turned it on me. If I hadn't taken a dive off the roof into that dumpster, my number might have been up.
It might be yet, boss, if we don't get that taken care of. You're leaking like a sieve. Still, you're lucky. That disciple don't ever let anyone walk away in one piece. Literally.
That one they call Chanteuse? I heard she leaves like a tarot card on each guy she kills.
Nah, Mikey, that's that fate chick. Chanteuse is the one with the murderous voice. She's like one of them, Greek sirens or something.
Listen to you guys. A bunch of mama's boys scared of their shadows. There's only four of them, you dumb apes. You can't whack four creeps. Two of them are broads, for hell's sake.
What's the name of that other mug?
Let's see, Disciple, Chanteuse, Fate, and, what's his name?
A long scythe tore through the darkness from above, impaling Kelly through the chest. Impossibly, the blade dragged Kelly upward over the edge of the roof, where stood the black robes and dark hood of Death Incarnate.
Reaper!
But there was nothing there to shoot.
Get me out of here!
Julius spat up blood. He tried to run across the midway, but his legs felt loose and rubbery beneath him. Salvatore grabbed his boss, throwing his shoulder under his arm and dragging him toward the funhouse across the way. Salvatore busted down the entrance door to the nearest building and dragged Julius inside. The remaining Moxon hitmen pushed their way through the door after them, tumbling into a mirror maze. Guns raised, all they could see around them were reflections of themselves seemingly going into forever. The stark light of the overhead bulb was repeating in all directions.
I don't know. Maybe we should go back, boss.
What? Go back out there? Are you kidding me? It's just a kid's maze, Sal. We'll go out the back and blow this whole scene.
They plunged into the maze together. The shifting images with the raised weapons they saw were themselves, but now and then a face would appear that was not their own, vanishing so quickly it was impossible to tell if the image had been real or an illusion.
Hey, boss. What is it, Mikey? You hear that?
Hear what?
Michael!
Ma?
Michael! Please help me! I'm so afraid!
Boss! They got Ma!
What? What are you talking about? What would your mom be doing in this nut house?
What do they want, Michael? I don't know what they want.
Ma! It's my Ma, boss! They got her! I'm coming, Ma! Don't you worry, Ma! I'm coming!
Mikey plunged down a side corridor, his reflections scattering in all directions.
You want I should get him, boss?
I don't think so.
Julius dropped painfully to the ground as Salvatore shielded him. Several bodies fell through the collapsing mirrors in front of them.
Hey! Knock it off!
Hey, boss. Check this out.
Julius stared at the bodies on the floor in front of him.
Who are these guys?
They're Falcone's boys. And that one over there is one of Rossetti's. Looks like we got company, boss.
We've been set up, all of us. Those apocalypse creeps have us butchering each other for them. Well, I'm tired of this game, and I don't want to play anymore. Hey, everybody out there, down! Sal, our luck can't get no worse. Break me a few mirrors.
Salvador eased Julius into the back of the Cadillac. Julius knew the upholstery in the back would be ruined by his blood, but he could afford it, if he lived that long.
You want we should take you to Gotham Hospital, boss?
No! We might as well walk into the DA's office and start singing. Who's that? That Dr. Lewis is always going on about? That rich friend of his?
Rains. Baines.
Wayne! Dr. Thomas Wayne, old Pat Wayne's kid. He can patch me up and we can keep one step ahead of the bulls.
But where are we gonna find him, boss?
Julius grabbed Salvatore by the collar.
That party! Lewis was going to some big-shot fancy party at the Kane Mansion tonight. Wayne will be there, along with every other money-spoiled snob of Gotham. That's where we'll find him. How many boys we got left?
Counting us? 10, maybe 15 now. They're all piled into a couple of cars behind us like clowns in a circus.
Well, that's enough to handle the hoi polloi. Tell the boys we're going to crash a party over at the Kane Mansion.
You want me to go out there?
Am I talking to myself? I'm bleeding here! Just do it!
Salvatore was glad to see the windows of both cars roll down slightly. He didn't want to have to stand out in the open and say it twice.
Moxie says we're going to the party at the Kane Mansion.
Where is this Kane place?
It's in Bristol. Read the map, knucklehead, and stay on a bumper.
But why there?
There's a doc there by the name of Wayne who's gonna patch up the boss.
From a hidden spot nearly 20 feet away, the entire conversation had been overheard. Thomas examined the costume that had been carefully laid out on the divan in the dressing room of his East Wing suite. It had been his parents' inviolate territory when he was growing up, and he still felt like an intruder for moving into the rooms. He had finished showering and had shaved once more for the evening. He wore a towel wrapped around his waist and considered just what one could do to make his attire for the evening less ridiculous. Thomas was uncomfortable with costumes in the first place and had asked Jarvis to secure one for him to wear to the party. Jarvis had assured him that the character was extremely popular, but Thomas only knew it as coming from an old 1920s silent movie that his father used to make him watch now and then when Thomas was a boy. It was about the only activity Thomas remembered doing with his father that didn't involve an argument or a beating. Unfortunately, this costume had been assembled incorrectly, with tights and trunks rather than the proper leggings, and with a cape that looked more like something Dracula might wear than a caballero. The mask was a hooded cowl in the style of the old Fairbanks films. Whoever had assembled the costume seemed to have done a rush job of it, tossing in tall black boots and a wide leather belt more suited to a buccaneer. By the time the costume had arrived, it was too late to do anything about changing it. Perhaps he could find something more suitable than the tights and the trunks to wear under his costume. Thomas turned back to the mirror over the sink. There was still shaving cream on his face. He splashed water from the basin to remove it.
Good evening, Thomas.
Thomas looked up into the mirror.
It's been a long, long time.
Denholm.
Thomas wondered how Sinclair had managed to get into the mansion, and whether he had done so unnoticed.
Denholm. Yes, I suppose I will allow that I was Denholm Sinclair. It pains me to admit it, though. Pains me terribly. It was a pain that you gave me, Thomas. Remember, I wasn't the man you thought I should be. And you were going to fix me, weren't you? And you did fix me, Thomas. You fixed me better than you could have hoped. I couldn't be old Denny Sinclair any longer because Denny was a liar and a cheat. A guy who burned up little orphans in their beds just to cover up his extensive fraud. So I've become what you wanted me to be, Thomas. And I'm bringing justice down on the very vermin and predators among whom I once numbered. Denholm Sinclair is dead. I buried everything he ever was. And now I'm the man Martha Kane asked that I become. And I have you to thank for it, my dear friend. I am so very grateful.
Denholm?
That's not who I am!
Okay.
Thomas held both his palms forward, acutely aware that he was only dressed in a towel.
What should I call you then?
They call me the Disciple.
Sinclair's left hand pressed against his abdomen. Thomas could see blood seeping out between his fingers.
The Disciple?
Your Disciple, Thomas. You made me strong. You made me wise. You made me see the purpose of my existence.
What purpose?
To be the cure, Doctor.
We are the antibody of Gotham, my companions and I. We flow through the lifeblood of the city, searching for the antigens of crime and corruption, of intimidation and greed. Fate finds them. Chanteuse calls them home. And the Reaper, well, he is always busy.
And you?
Me? Why, I am the judge, the jury, and sometimes the executioner all in one.
You've been very busy. Too busy if the newspaper reports are true.
It's a living. But it's all been nothing compared to what's coming tonight. Moxon, Rossetti, and even Falcone all set aside their differences tonight so they could face their common enemy. But the laugh was on them. We were ready for them. Now Moxon's got a few slugs in him, and he's on his way up to the Kane Mansion with what remains of his goon squad.
The Kanes? Why would he go there?
Last time I saw him, he didn't look too good. I guess his little boy bragged you up to his old man. He needs a doctor who knows how to keep his mouth shut. So he's looking for you.
Oh, no.
You needn't worry, Thomas. I'll take care of them. I'll put them out of their misery.
Blood stained the disciples' palms, fingers, and forearms. Thomas realized those stains had not all come from Sinclair's own wounds.
You know, we're a lot alike, you and I. It's just that my surgery is a good deal messier than yours in the end. And come to think of it, while I'm cleaning out the Moxon cancer at the Kane's Ball, there are a few among the upper crust I think could use my attention, too. A few of them who could use a good cleaning as well.
The line of Sinclair's moral judgment was shifting more and more toward the perfect and the ideal. Thomas realized, if this continued, everyone at the ball could be in mortal danger, simply by not being perfect. Thomas had to stop him.
You're hurt.
Can you help me, old friend?
Disciple sat down on the divan next to the costume.
I seem to be in need of your assistance.
I'll need to get my bag.
Your bag?
My medical bag. It's downstairs. It will only take me...
No, that's not the help I need.
But it will only take...
No!
All right. What do you need?
I need your help to exact justice on those who are unjust.
How?
I need to be you.
Batcave, Wayne Manor, Bristol, 11:39 p.m., present day. Bruce stepped up to the Batmobile on its service platform where it was recharging. He considered fueling it, but decided there wasn't time, and besides, the distance he had to go wasn't that far. He started pulling out the components of his Batsuit. The capacitors were somewhat discharged from the previous night's activities, but he gauged them sufficient for his needs. He began assembling the Batsuit around him as a knight might have donned his armor, connecting its components until it was a seamless whole. He finished with a cowl, completing his costume for the party at the abandoned Kane Mansion next door. Batman passed as a shadow beneath the porte cochere that dominated the main entrance to the Kane Mansion up the broad, deserted steps. The main doors, long since barred, were now open wide, inviting him into the dark foyer beyond. He slipped into the enveloping shadows, closing his eyes to get his bearings. The old foyer sprang into three-dimensional relief in his mind, a place at once familiar and alien. He had played here as a boy. His mother would stand at the bottom of the staircase and call him down from the landing above. He always tried to slide down the wide banister, and his mother would always warn him it was too dangerous. It was a game they played, here on these steps. Batman frowned in the shadows, too dark to be seen. That was before Grandma Kane died, and his mother sold the property to Kane Corp in 65. The entire estate had gone into receivership following Martha Wayne's murder. The company folded not long afterward and locked the doors, and the estate had been in litigation ever since. Gotham Bank acquired the paper on the grounds 20 years ago and locked the doors on a property it could not maintain, and for which it never gave a damn. The music drifted from the back of the foyer. Batman moved toward the doors, opened his eyes, and pushed the doors open. Kane Mansion, Bristol, 11:44 p.m., October 26th, 1958.
Ladies and gentlemen.
Bertie was dressed as an Elizabethan footman and was all too pleased to maintain the appearance for his part. Brightly costumed oddities stopped dancing to look, while those crowding the edges of the dance floor turned in curiosity. Harold Ryder shifted his Bell & Howell 70D 16mm newsreel camera toward the entrance and pressed the shutter trigger. He was dressed as a cowboy for the occasion, taking for a costume what he considered to be the path of least ridiculousness. The party was a bore. He preferred to be working the crime beat, but crime was down. He had heard about some action going down on Amusement Mile earlier in the evening, but by then he was stuck out here covering the cotillion crowd. Still, only a certain few of the guests rated this kind of general introduction, and their entrance was worth a few feet of film for the news broadcasts later in the evening. He only had a few feet of film left on this reel anyway, and this would give him an excuse to run out the film before putting in a new one.
Who's it this time?
Virginia Vale, reporter for the Gotham Gazette, was in her little Bo Peep outfit, complete with bonnet. Harold was checking the focus on the camera.
I don't know. Number 501 of the 500, I suppose?
Dr. Thomas Wayne.
Dr. Wayne looks like he's been exercising.
But get a load of that costume.
Harold hadn't bothered with a bulky and bulky sound equipment and could say whatever he pleased so long as he said it in a way that wouldn't shake the camera.
Who's he supposed to be?
The Kane press release says he's coming as Douglas Fairbanks.
Fairbanks? Then what's with the tights and the trunks?
If that's Douglas Fairbanks, then I'm Betty Page.
Don't get my hopes up.
Harold released the shutter trigger, pulling the camera down in front of him. Without thinking, he flipped out the winding key, holding it steady in his right hand while twisting the body of the camera with his left. It was an old habit from his days as a war photographer in the South Pacific, making sure the camera was wound quickly and always ready.
I'll tell you what, though. He looks more like a bat than a hero in that getup.
Well, it seems to be working for someone.
Martha Kane, in her flapper dress and wearing a sequined white domino mask above her dazzling smile, crossed the floor and took her new guest by the arm. Kane Mansion, Bristol. 11:47 p.m., present day. The air smelled strongly of burning dust and lavender. Batman's eyes narrowed behind his cowl. The ballroom was enormous, and the extent of it was difficult to see. Everything was in motion, the room filled with dizzy, sweeping dance. Long red silk streamers cascaded downward from the cracked dome ceiling overhead, suspended from a complex of horizontal metal rods, motors, and more rods. An enormous mechanical mobile that nearly filled the hall. Between the bolts of silk, several dozen life-sized mannequin couples swung inches above the floor. The figures, suspended from the mobile above, swayed and whirled in their poses, each costumed for a masquerade. Batman stepped gingerly into the room. The walls seemed to writhe beneath shifting shadows of the silk cascades and suspended figures. Gaudy chandeliers glowed too brightly overhead, beneath their cheap linen coverings. A pair of suspended marionette figures swung into view. One was dressed in what looked like a bad imitation of some of his early bat suits. A female figure hung limp in a matching dance pose, suspended from the ever-shifting rods overhead. This one was clothed in a flapper dress, with the head lolled backward, jaw hanging open.
Amanda.
She swung almost at once out of view, wheeling into revolutions of the shifting figures suspended from the ceiling and disappearing among the red silk drapes that also swung in arcs through the hall. Batman reached down without looking to his utility belt. The Teflon-bladed batarang snapped open in his hand. The figures jerked slightly.
My name is Dr. Thomas Wayne. I suppose this is my testimony, or perhaps my confession regarding the events of October 26, 1958 at the Kane Charity Ball. I've kept silent far too long.
Batman stepped in among the costumed mannequins, prepared to cut the cables should the life-sized marionettes get in his way. He could see the red flapper dress of Amanda ahead of him through the maze of shifting forms.
I could not rest until I had left a record for my sons, both of whom are dear to me. I could not bear the thought that they might be confronted by my past without hearing from me the reasons for what happened. How it had all gone wrong, despite my most noble intentions.
One of the mannequins to his right moved. Batman ducked and pushed under the arm of the Confederate soldier, shoving the Uzi in the soldier's hand upward. The Marie Antoinette mannequin in front of him jumped from the impact of the bullets, the head exploding into plaster shards. A number of mannequins dropped into a crouch on the floor. Some of these costumes held plaster, and some held breathing killers. Musketeers, ninjas, pirates, and shoguns rose against him. But they had one thing in common. They held identical Kukri-Tanto machete blades.
So I make this record for their sakes, and for the sake of my own soul's peace.
He checked the Batsuit power levels and discovered they were at 38%. There had been no time to recharge the Batsuit since its last use earlier that day. It would have to be enough.
The music's changed, but it's still the same song. Time to dance.
Kane Mansion, Bristol, 11:53 p.m., October 26th, 1958. Lou Moxon stood in his gray cowboy costume with his domino mask, sipping a martini at the side of the dance floor and watching his friend in the ridiculous bat costume dance with a flapper hostess. It looked as though Thomas Wayne was finally making some progress with Martha after all. Lou had heard rumblings around the coffee klatch about something big going down tonight. His father and his old way of running the town was going the way of the dodo. They were all running scared of these apocalypse boogeymen.
Let them sweat. I got my ticket out.
Lou raised his glass to the bat as he swung past him on the ballroom floor.
Thank you, Dr. Wayne.
In that moment, the double doors at the end of the ballroom slammed open. Salvatore, followed by six more from the Moxon gang, pushed their way into the room. Big Eddie drew up his Thompson.
Everybody down on the ground! Play nice and nobody gets hurt.
Lou slowly sat down, along with the fear-stricken partygoers.
We're just looking for a doctor who can make a house call. Where's Dr. Wayne?
Kane Mansion, Bristol, 11:53 p.m., present day. Batman continued to use his momentum against the Confederate soldier, swinging them both on the suspending cables. This launched them into an arc, rising higher off the ground as they both cleared a pair of pirates ducking out of the way. The Confederate's back slammed into the mirrored wall of the ballroom, and he went limp beneath the Batman. Batman tore the Uzi out of the unconscious man's hand, taking it apart with practiced ease. Two pirates attempted to flank Batman, while the Cavalier tried to distract him from the front. Amanda and her red flapper dress flashed past him now, among the red silk drapes and the still-circling mannequins. The alarm in his cowl made Batman glance down at his right leg. A long gash ran across the thigh of his batsuit. Black liquid trickled from the cut.
What kind of blades are they using?
The Dark Knight chose his target, a Union cavalry officer just to his left. He feigned into the man, who swung his blade too soon. Batman dodged, body-kicked the man in the chest, sending him flying backward and scattering the suspended mannequins. Batman followed him into the thicket of costumed figures and then leapt on him almost at once. He drove his left knee into the man's wrist, causing him to release the blade at once. Batman's right hand drew up to take the Union officer out of the fight for good. His fist didn't come down. An acrobatic blonde woman in a dark green leotard had bound his hand in one of the long bolts of silk suspended from the ceiling. With deadly grace, a second woman, a brunette, spun down another bolt from the ceiling.
Query and Echo?
Riddler's henchwomen were in on this too? Was every criminal in the city being played? The musketeer and the ninjas closed in, with Batman's wrist hopelessly tangled in the silk. He gripped the cloth with both hands, trying to climb it, but Echo was shifting around him, wrapping the second bolt of silk around his swinging feet. Batman kicked hard, sending Echo spinning away, but she steadied the spin, swinging back toward him. Query drew in a third bolt of the silk, swinging it around the Batman's torso, under his arms, pinning down the cape. As the swordsman below moved in, Batman swung his legs upward, wrapping his feet around the silk above him. This pulled him up out of the way of the slashing blades, just as Query swung in again, trailing the long silk behind her. Batman pushed against the cloth with his feet, using his mass for leverage. He struck Query a solid backhand blow, sending her into a fast spin. But Echo had wrapped his left hand from behind. Batman pulled hard against the fabric. The weave was supple enough that it wouldn't break or shear. He had nothing solid of which he could push or have any leverage. and he could feel the life bleeding out of the Batsuit.
Tommy, what do we do?
The man in the mask and the cape put a reassuring hand on Martha's shoulder. He hadn't spoken a word to her all the time they were dancing, with the adrenaline of fear coursing through her. When he did speak, it never registered that the man's voice wasn't Thomas's.
I'm Thomas Wayne. What do you want?